Refugees from Afghanistan land on the shores of the Great Salt Lake.
They don't just need food. That's kind of easy. They also need friends.
This hour, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, a one-hour look inside the series by KSL Podcasts. What happened when refugees of the crisis in Afghanistan arrived in Utah? Podcast producer Andrea Smarden is our host on KSL News Radio.
From KSL Podcasts, I'm Andrea Smarden, host of Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Do you remember when the U.S. military withdrew from Afghanistan and the Taliban seized power basically overnight? We saw people crushed in the crowds at the Kabul airport, children separated from parents, and people so desperate to flee they were clinging to the wings of an airplane. Then this disaster from halfway across the world arrived on our doorstep. My focus in the podcast is on the regular people, friends and neighbors like you and me, who tried to fill in the gaps in this crisis. Today, we're talking to one of those people who didn't know it when she started, but her life would be transformed by the strangers she meets. Her name is Jenny Hua. She's a mother of five. And in 2020, her family moved to Utah, where she says she feels at home because she grew up here. Then in 2021, when our newest neighbors from Afghanistan started arriving in Salt Lake City, she simply responded to a call for help, though she didn't know what the first step would be or where it would take her. Joining me in the studio is Jenny Hua, along with my colleague from KSL Podcasts, Amy Donaldson.
So Jenny, I imagine you were like the rest of us watching what happened in Afghanistan. How did you respond?
Our general authorities of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have said in past general conferences to serve refugees and to help. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to try to do that. And so when this happened, I thought, well, they never said to stop serving refugees, right? So now we have this whole flood of them coming to Salt Lake City. And I'm like, well, I suppose everyone will go out there and they'll probably go help.
You'll have to fight for an opportunity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought probably, you know, and I'm like, well,
Utah likes to see itself as a place that is welcoming to refugees, as a refuge, right?
Well, it is high. Yeah. We always rank high in service, right? Mm-hmm. Like service is always a big deal. And we take pride in that, right?
But I want to do something meaningful, like that really could matter. And I thought, well, maybe we could take a foster child in because they had a foster child program. They still have. And I thought, well, that's like a big deal, like a child from a different culture. And I don't know anything about their culture. And I thought, well, I want to find out more about who they are. So that was all like playing in my head for a few weeks. And then I went to an event, a Utah Hazara Association event, where they were going to host a dinner and do a fundraiser. They spoke about the new Afghan families who are coming, and you could come and meet them and have some Afghan food and learn more about their culture. And it happened to be on my birthday. And so I said, hey, let's do this for my birthday.
Did you have a picture in your mind or like what you thought this was going to be like, the service?
No.
So you were just like, no. I just want to do something.
Yeah. I just want to do something. And okay. I mean, I thought I would help a foster child or like one family.
You did find someone there.
Yeah. I did.
Yeah. One person. Who did you meet?
I met Seema, and she was a single mom because she was in the Special Forces unit in Afghanistan, and her husband also was working in the military, and he was killed in battle. So she was a single mom, and she'd come here because her life was in danger, and she had her little baby boy. And she, at that event, she told her story.
When we went to carry out operations during our duty, we saw many young people being killed in front of our eyes. And we said that they have their own families, wives, and children. What will happen to them? Not knowing that one day I will lose the dearest person in my life.
I was really touched by her story. There was a translator translating for her, but she was just telling it so soulfully. And you could tell that she was just in a really tragic place. Mm-hmm. So I think that affected everyone in the audience. Everyone really felt for her.
And so did you just go up to her and say, hi, I want to help you? Or
so they had a dinner. And in Afghan culture, you sit on the floor to eat on carpets. And we were sitting in a large circle on the floor. And the woman who sat next to me, her name's Nazifa. And she is one of the founding members, I guess you could say, of this association. And she told me more about it. And she seemed to be a natural leader in the group. I asked her, I said, hey, can I help Seema? How can I help? I mean, she's so sad. Like, what can we do right now to help this poor woman? Like, does she have a place to stay? Does she have food? She obviously needs someone to put their arms around her. And so she said, yeah, you can be her friend.
I think it's interesting that when you started, you said, how can I learn more? Right. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. you went to this event to learn.
Right.
Like, who are these people? What do they need? And it wasn't like, I'm going to volunteer and like, yeah, I'm going right. to give you my used coat. It was more like,
no,
I'm going to go find out more.
Right. I wanted to learn about their culture and just who they are and like why they're here.
I do think it's interesting that you didn't make any assumptions about what they might need.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. You just said, like, I'm going to go and figure it out. Like, they'll tell me.
Because that's something that's come up in the podcast is like people want to help. Your immediate response, you see this desperation is I'm going to help this person. But there's something that needs to happen first.
Well, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, like Seema is a good example. So I got to know her briefly. And all I knew from our first interaction was that she seemed like desperately sad and like someone who had nothing and was here and needed help in some way.
But did she just need help? Did she just need stuff?
No. And I came to find out that she actually had already in place more help than maybe anyone else who came to Utah, just about, because she had a group of female U.S. soldiers who had formed a nonprofit to help their comrades from Afghanistan. She had that group behind her, and she already had a mentor who was American and who was looking out for her. And so though she seemed like the person who needed the most help, she actually wasn't, you know.
She
did
helped you
still.
But she helped kind of give you entrance into this world,
yeah,
right?
And she did need help. She did need a friend, like, here on the ground. Her mentor lived in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so Seema did still need help. But you can make the assumption like, oh, this poor widow, oh my goodness, like, that's where my heart went. But then as you learn more, you're like, oh, you have this other friend. And like, this is more than just you. And this is making connections with more people and working together. So it's not what you necessarily expect when you jump in.
But I think there's something about the person that's right there nearby, the neighbor or the friend that's different too, that can play a different role, right? And mm-hmm. I think a lot of times when we hear about refugees, we think, well, there's resettlement agencies, there's government programs. And then in this case, there's another organization, the Sisters of Service. So what is it that's different about the role that you could play?
Well, I think everyone needs friends and someone to show them love and just have trust in. That's the biggest thing, is someone that they can trust. Because when I'm in a vulnerable position, I don't want to tell my deep inner feelings or my hurt or anxiety to a stranger. I want to tell someone that I can trust. I think that plays a very significant role, because when you develop that trusting relationship, then you can ask that person for the things that you need. Whereas, like, if you have a government employee that is required to help you, then maybe your needs that are obvious are helped. But the needs that aren't so obvious, those needs aren't met. And in the case of the refugees who I've met, they have some significant needs that you can't see on paper or when you first meet them.
We have to take a break here, but when we come back, Jenny breaks bread with her new friends. In the process, she not only learns about how to help with those deeper needs, she receives something powerful in return.
Don't we all need to trust the news stories we hear? Now more than ever, don't we deserve to have trust in the facts? That is what this station is for. We have you covered on KSL News Radio.
Hi, I'm Andrea Smartin, host of Stranger Becomes Neighbor, a podcast about the Afghan arrivals in our communities and the friends they make who help them rebuild their lives in America. I'm here in the studio along with my colleague at KSL Podcasts, Amy Donaldson, and someone who plays a prominent role in the podcast, Jenny Hua. Jenny didn't really know what she was getting into when she started this journey. She thought she would help one person, but as she gets more involved, she says she ends up meeting and assisting something like 50 families.
Jenny, were you surprised by the depth of the relationships that you made?
Yeah, I was. I was surprised many times. Like one time, another family who I became friends with invited us over to eat in their home, my family and a friend and myself. They'd been here for a little bit longer. They were helping all their Afghan friends, but the father was still like, you know, minimum wage job and they have 5 children. And so they still didn't have enough means of their own, but they made the most beautiful, amazing supper for us. It was delicious and they put a lot of time into it. And we were sitting around on the floor and they always make naan bread and it's a flat bread. The host will like rip the bread and hand it to each of the people at the meal. So my friend Masima, she tore the bread and handed it to me. And in that moment, I just had this overwhelming feeling that she was like Christ to me. She had embodied that spirit of giving and love. And I've never felt that kind of powerful love in a symbolic way in any other situation in my life. It was really profound. And I was totally surprised.
I experienced this a little bit myself as a journalist, following people around, following you around and the Afghans that you were visiting. And I met this family where the father, he had an almost 2-year-old child and his wife was pregnant. And you sent me a picture of an eviction notice. He was about to start a new job, but he didn't have the money yet. We didn't know if he was going to have a home when the baby came. And we went to their house to find out more about the situation. And at the end of the interview, his wife brings out this whole meal that she had been making. I was actually bothered because in the interview, she was making noise in the kitchen. I was like, oh, that's gonna mess up my interview. Oh. Not realizing that she was making food for us, for all of us.
Oh, what did you make? This is a whole meal.
Piyaz aur badamjan dara diga dosta. There is onions, tomatoes, and eggs. And this is beans and chickpeas for breakfast.
And this bread?
Naan shayad khana khatin.
Naan khana khatin.
Yeah, it's homemade bread.
You made this? Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
They can't afford to pay their rent. They can't pay their bills. They can't afford to give away food. So it's like this simultaneous sinking feeling in my stomach. And at the same time, like so moved by the generosity, mm-hmm. right?
A big thing I've learned from them, like if you aren't trained to see the economics of a choice, which apparently they have not been trained to see, it's like they can't afford not to share with friends. They've taught me that you can't afford not to share.
Or maybe it's just worth more to them. It's more valuable to them to show you love
than
to show that you're welcome there.
And go hungry the next day.
Yeah, that's more valuable to them than saving their money or making a good economic choice.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the relationship. The connection and the love are more valuable to them mm-hmm. than eating. And that's maybe what we're supposed to learn through fasting. I mean, there's many times where I've been the learner.
You've talked about the lessons you've learned. Like, what's different about Jenny? Because you opened your heart to...
Yeah, I've been completely changed. I'm so happy.
And were you unhappy before?
No.
Okay. All right.
I wasn't unhappy. Uh-huh. I'm even happier. I just have a peace in my heart and in my mind against maybe the troubles of the world. And also, I think it's built a spiritual resilience in me. For example, like when Ukraine was attacked by Russia, again, another, you know, catastrophic tragedy, you could feel, and I had a glimpse of this thought in my mind, wow, the world is really ending. Like, what can I do to help? I live on the other side of the world. I feel so helpless. You could feel
it's
really
too much. Overwhelmed.
It's overwhelming. Yeah. You could feel really down. But at the time, I was helping all these Afghan families, and I thought, it's okay. If I help the person who's in front of me, the person who is in my backyard, I am bringing this light to the world, and I am being fed by their light. And we have this bright light going on. And if that happens all over the world, we can fight this negativity and this selfishness, and we'll win. There is definitely hope because I'm living it. And so that's how it's changed me. I know that you can be happy in whatever circumstance. The world can have peace. And you just start with yourself in the place where you are and minister, serve to an individual. And it is going to be okay. And that is different from who I was, you know, 2.5 years ago. I think that's what Christ means by turning to Him and by Him changing you and making you into a being who is closer to, you know, divinity. I was able to experience that firsthand. It's amazing.
Coming up after the break, Amy and I will talk about our takeaways and moments of inspiration from the podcast Stranger Becomes Neighbor.
Refugees from Afghanistan land on the shores of the Great Salt Lake.
They don't just need food. That's kind of easy. They also need friends.
This hour, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, a one-hour look inside the series by KSL Podcasts. What happened when refugees of the crisis in Afghanistan arrived in Utah? Podcast producer Andrea Smarden is our host on KSL News Radio.
From KSL Podcasts, I'm Andrea Smarden, host of Stranger Becomes Neighbor. In the podcast, I really wanted to follow the regular people helping those who landed in our communities from Afghanistan. But many of these so-called ordinary people ended up being sources of inspiration for me. I'm here with my colleague, Amy Donaldson, and we're talking about some of our takeaways and transformative moments from the podcast.
So, Andrea, you and I both watched this unfold on television, same as everybody else, right? But I mean, we talked about how heartbreaking it was to see those images and to see what was happening. And it was horrifying. It felt so big. And so I didn't even think about what can I do?
Yeah. Well, I thought what was interesting to me was that so many people did step up and want to help in the beginning, right? There was this immediate instinctive response when you see that kind of desperation, you know, people falling off of wings of airplanes. I mean, that they're that desperate to get out of the country. They're being crushed in the crowds at the airport. And in Utah, where we want to be a refuge for people who are persecuted, who are fleeing their homes, it's part of our identity, right? And so I could tell that everyone was going to respond in that moment. But what I was wondering was, what was going to happen a few months later? I think this is what we do, right? Like we want to respond in the moment when we see this terrible headline. But then there's another headline of another terrible incident. You know, then not too long after we had the invasion of Ukraine, and then we had hundreds of thousands of people fleeing their home there. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of this thing where it's easy to be like, oh, what could I possibly do? This is a global situation. It's so complicated. What can I do in my own life, in my own neighborhood to impact it? And so it's been remarkable throughout this podcast to follow people who are helping. Mm-hmm. And it's been empowering for me because it is easy to feel hopeless. And there were some people that I followed that were just remarkable that in the face of really complicated problems, they stuck with it. They said, I'm going to be there for you, even if it's a problem I don't know how to fix.
The thing that I thought was remarkable about some of these people who showed up and they maybe didn't have any idea what they were getting into or what it was going to look like or how long they were even committing for, right? Mm-hmm. Or even really, they certainly didn't understand the depth of impact it was going to have on their own lives. Mm-hmm. But they showed up. And like you said, they didn't give up.
There's a question that I pose in the podcast. When the world around us is in upheaval, what can one person do? There's a moment when a woman beautifully articulates an answer from her experience. Emily Nuvan had only recently graduated from law school when she volunteers to help Seema, an Afghan soldier from the female tactical platoon, file her asylum application. Emily takes down the details of her story about how her husband was killed while working with the U.S. military. She reviews Seema's photos, including graphic pictures of the aftermath of bombings. As Emily absorbs this trauma, she worries that if Seema and her young son are not granted asylum, they could be sent back to Afghanistan. She feels the overwhelming weight of the responsibility of having someone's life in her hands.
I started driving home and I was listening to some music. And a song came on by Jewel. Love her. She has this song that's called Hands. And it's basically just recognizing that, yeah, like I am aware that my efforts are so small in the context of, you know, how big these problems are, but I'm still going to do them. And there's like one phrase in that song that says, I won't be made useless. I won't be idle with despair, which was just so striking. That yes, I'd seen the chaos and the problems in Afghanistan and the horror of war. And you think, well, what can I do? It's not like I can go over there and, you know, remove the Taliban and make it so these people aren't refugees. And so because the problem is so big, it's easy to get lost in that despair. But seeing just this army of people helping and just that we all do little pieces of things. We don't let despair stop us, but it has to be a choice. You know, it's a choice. I'm not going to let the evil that's out there in the world stop me from the little bit of good that I can do.
Emily didn't really know what she was signing up for when she took on this pro bono case, but she made a choice to do what she could. It was that kind of personal commitment that I also observed when I talked to American service members like Matt Zeller, a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He says he owes his life to an Afghan interpreter who shot and killed two men who were about to kill him. What struck me about Matt was how the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan affected him so personally. He called it a moral injury, and he said the only way he could heal from this kind of wound was to help the Afghan allies who had helped Americans.
That moral injury, I'm telling you, I didn't get it. At first, I really didn't. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I'd heard all about it from Vietnam vets. I didn't understand it in the way that I now live it and have been living with it for the better part of the last year. You know, the people I was trying to help get out of the evacuation, I was only able to get out 5 of 25 people that I was personally trying to assist to get on flights. 19 of them are still back there in hiding. One of them's dead. We have this ethos in the military. You're supposed to leave it better than you found it. This is the only way I know how to leave it better than I found it.
You see your fates as tied together.
They're completely intertwined at this point.
I'm in a veterans group. One thing I love about my military friends is like the loyalty is forever.
Yeah. What's really struck me about the service members is they made this personal connection with the people that they worked with in Afghanistan, and they made a personal commitment, and they take that seriously to their core. Mm-hmm. And that's something that most of us Americans don't know and don't understand. What I've learned in talking to American service members for this podcast is they're so alone with this. They're carrying this heavy weight and other people don't understand. And so when they see people come together to help the Afghans that are here, that affects them. It also affects them when we don't help the Afghans.
Yeah.
As far as their morale, like what was it all for, right? Mm-hmm. And are we taking care of the people that we made this commitment to?
Andrea, I just want to thank you for taking the time and really for approaching this project in the same way that I see the people in your podcast approaching service with this open heart and open mind. And I think the product is beautiful. and so happy to be even a tiny part of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
Coming up after the break, we find out how a small town builds a community of support for refugees, fueled entirely by volunteers.
Don't we all need to trust the news stories we hear? Now more than ever, don't we deserve to have trust in the facts? That is what this station is for. We have you covered on KSL News Radio.
From KSL Podcasts, I'm Andrea Smartin, host of Stranger Becomes Neighbor. In the podcast, I was interested in the regular people who stepped up to help their newest neighbors from Afghanistan. And over the course of my reporting, I came across a remarkable organization called the Blacksburg Refugee Partnership. They help refugees with all aspects of resettlement and rebuilding their lives. But what's amazing is that it's run entirely by volunteers. This small town in Virginia has figured out how to come together and build a community of grassroots support. Today, I'm talking to a co-founder of the Blacksburg Refugee Partnership, Scott Bailey, whose day job is not at all related to refugees.
Scott, you're a professor at Virginia Tech in space science and engineering. How does a person like you end up co-founding and running a refugee organization?
It was church with a pastor that I'm close to and another close friend talking about what's going on in the world and problems we see and wishing we could do more. And next thing you know, we were an organization. People volunteered to join us. And donors said, we want to help you help some of these families. And so in the course of a few months, we went from 1 to 2 to 4 to 7 families that we're supporting. All grassroots, all neighbors coming together to decide we're going to help these families.
When the evacuation of Afghanistan happened, about 80,000 Afghans were coming to the U.S. What was that conversation like for your group?
You have to remember, we didn't see this coming. But as soon as that became apparent, the leader of the secular society came and said, hey, a lot of women are going to lose their education. If you can get them here and signed up, we will provide the scholarships to back you up. So we instantly started making calls and trying to find which group we could get attached with. That led to the female tactical platoon. And as soon as people started hearing those stories, they lined up. They volunteered to work with them. And amazingly, the people with the skill sets came to us. We transformed literally in a couple months as an organization. But it was because of the people who rose their hand.
Yeah, you ended up taking in Seema, who's featured in our podcast, a member of the Afghan Female Tactical Platoon, the FTPs, that assisted U.S. Special Forces. So she moved from Utah to be in your program. And there were already several FTPs working with the Blacksburg Refugee Partnership. What do you think those unique needs are?
That's a complicated question. Remember, everybody who comes here went through something very difficult. They lost everything. They lost their home. They're no longer with their families. They know what their families are going through while they're here, right? They have a roof over their head. They're safe. So there's a sort of survivor's guilt that goes on. I would argue that that effect is amplified for the members of the female tactical platoon. In some cases, their family being persecuted at home because of who these FTPs are. And at the same time, you got to learn English and you got to go to school and maybe have a job, right? You have to keep moving. So they're dealing with all of that at once. But I don't want to describe them as needy people. These are some of the toughest people I ever met, but they have a lot on their shoulders.
Seema told me when I talked to her that she was much happier in Blacksburg. What do you think are the important elements to being that community that the FTPs and other refugees need?
First, I'm happy she said that. That means a lot. We think of ourselves as sort of helpers, but I like the word partner better. We don't see them as people who are needy. They're people we respect and are even inspired by. And so we treat them that way. Where they can do things on their own, we have them do them on their own, but we're kind of side by side with them. We say that our work is done when they have all the same problems we do, and we're just hanging out with them as neighbors. And you can't underestimate the amount of inspiration we feel as we work with these people. There's a lot of mutual respect. When you have love and respect and a common goal, things can really just come together if you let it.
In the podcast, several people who've befriended and helped the arrivals from Afghanistan ran up against the limits of what they could do as individuals. Has that happened for you or for other people involved in the Blacksburg Refugee Partnership?
The first thing you learn And we go through this every time we get a new family, right? In the beginning, it's all great. You're getting people in school, you're getting them working, you're getting them into a home, and the home is beautiful. People donate furniture, and it's wonderful. And then in 2 weeks, all that is sort of over. And now you go to pick them up to take them to a class, and they tell you that the Taliban came and visited my father's house last night and did something terrible or said something terrible. How do you help them with that? And you're saying, oh, I'm so sorry. Class starts in 10 minutes. You quickly realize that you are helping them with some important problems. But to be honest, the majority of what they're dealing with, you cannot help them with. And that's why I think the help part of this is not the biggest deal. I think what really matters is that we're partners with them. And because it's a loving, respectful relationship, they can share that, at least say what's going on with them and feel like they have some support, that they're not dealing with it alone. This doesn't take away the pain. I'm not pretending that at all. But I think this is one way we succeed, is that at least they know that people care. They're doing what their family back home wants for them. And that's at least one part of helping them get through each day. I don't want to act like we're saviors or anything like that. We're not. But I do think we come up with the best possible support system.
So for those interested in doing something like you're doing in their own communities, do you have any advice? What elements have to be in place for this to work?
I really believe that within every community, there's a group of people, an army of people who want to help, but feel like they don't know how to take that first step. Be willing to ask questions, be willing to speak, and be willing to find your role. But otherwise, you don't need any special qualities or anything like that. And that worked in our case. It continues to work.
When you think about yourself before you started all of this, has this done anything for you to sort of change your life?
Absolutely. You know, I think all of us, we want to make a difference. We see these problems and we want to be a part of the solution. And they all seem so far away. When you start working with families like this, it brings it closer. You feel like you are a part of the solution. If you keep at it, at least for me, I found that the confidence to do more grows and grows. We don't have to be so distant from all these problems. We can be helpers.
Scott Bailey is a co-founder and president of the board for the Blacksburg Refugee Partnership. Stranger Becomes Neighbor is available wherever you listen to podcasts, or find us at kslpodcasts.com.